From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we are so very thankful for that. If your New Year's resolution is to make sure more people are engaged in constructive interreligious dialogue, please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
Dr. Ethan Lightman is a Yale neurology professor and a psychologist, and he's studying mystical experiences in the human brain and how these arise and where they come from, and almost, is there a God spot in the brain?
What happens when a successful corporate lawyer and real estate developer decides to write a religious novel? The scenario could be a recipe for disaster, right? I suppose that's true. But that's far from the case when the would-be author is Jeffrey Small, who has spent a lifetime studying world religions and synthesizing their wisdom in thoughtful and original ways. Instead, the result was the best-selling book, The Breath of God, published in 2012. And that book managed to hold number one positions in the seemingly unrelated categories of political thriller and religious studies simultaneously. Now he's following that up with The Jericho Deception, which is seeing a similar level of success. And on this week's show, you will meet that author, speaker, and educator, Jeff Small.
Happy solstice. In this season, may the light of hope and good tidings be born anew in your soul. Amen.
All over this country, you'll find vibrant, growing, and deeply spiritual faith communities that are successfully meeting the needs of new generations of faithful people, while being true at the same time to the timeless teachings of their traditions. This is profoundly good news. On this week's show, we'll highlight one of these communities, All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and its senior minister, the Reverend Marlon Lavenhar, who has grown All Souls into the largest Unitarian congregation in the country. But first...
Wow, Utah! Utah feels different.
On December 20th, a U.S. district judge in Salt Lake City surprised almost everyone by ruling that Utah's ban on same-gender marriage violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Now, the prevalence in Utah of the Mormon Church, which has actively worked to oppose marriage equality, adds much dramatic tension to this turn of events. As you would expect, there was an immediate rush to the figurative altar by enthusiastic couples, followed by the inevitable appeal to the Supreme Court by the conservative state, which was filed on New Year's Eve Day. Now, joining me now is a person who was right in the middle of all of this, Nicole Christensen, who married her partner, Natalie, on that very first day. Nicole, first of all, congratulations, and second, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Would you start, please, by just talking about the events of December 20th? How much of a surprise was Judge Robert Shelby's decision to you?
Judge Shelby's decision was completely a surprise. I was at home baking some holiday cookies. My now wife was driving home from a work white elephant gift party, and she called me and said, "Have you seen this article in the Salt Lake Tribune? Judge Shelby has overturned Amendment 3, and which... you know, was the gay marriage, the gay marriage ruling. And I said, "I can't believe it. Does that make Utah the 18th state to legalize gay marriage?" And she said, "Yes." And we just both started crying. It was just an incredible moment.
And how soon did one of you say to the other or both of you at the same time, "Let's take advantage of this right now"?
Well, we had been engaged since April, so for a few months we'd been engaged, and I'm always one of those people that is kind of a go-getter, and I said, you know, let's get down there to the courthouse and see what's going on and see if we can get married ourselves. And we rushed down there. We got some bridal bouquets on the way, and we were the, you know, when some of the first couples to get married. It was an incredible, incredible moment. People, you know, really underestimate how progressive Salt Lake City is. Salt Lake City is the biggest city in Utah, and we haven't had a Republican mayor since the mid-70s. And it was just this organic arrival of media, supporters, allies, gay couples, and it was pretty much a frenzy. The scene I would describe is we had our wedding certificate in our hands and we rushed down to the lobby and they said, okay, you can get married by a priest, a lawyer, or Mayor Ralph Becker. Who do you want? And we said, okay, we'll get married by the mayor, no problem. So it was pretty fun.
I bet it was. I have to just affirm what you've said about misperceptions of Salt Lake City. I remember doing a presentation there with actually a group of Mormons on the theme of religious freedom and same-gender marriage. And it was one of the most warm and enthusiastic audiences I've ever had, a very understanding group. I want to ask you, and you know, I don't know that this is a question, unfortunately, that gets asked to heterosexual couples as much, but what did it mean to you and to Natalie to suddenly be able to get married? What were the emotions of that?
The emotions of that day were so incredible. It was so incredible to be able to stand there with my wife and say, I commit to you and I have the full legal backing of the state behind me. And what that means is that she can now inherit my house. We can share tax benefits. I can be on her insurance. It's all these things that are so part of life, but seem like nuts and bolts, but are so significant and part of our life experience. And now we can share all those things together. We can share health decisions. We can share inheritance. We can share all of those things. And having that with the state of Utah saying, I grant you this full legal recognition, it was so powerful. There were tears flowing. I'll just say that.
Sure. Well, I do understand that, and I the reason I ask it is because I want our listeners to be fully in touch with the fact that this isn't just a political issue that you want to win. It is a life issue that you want to experience.
Absolutely.
I know you've done a lot of work in support of marriage equality, but the history of your work makes it a very interesting story. Will you tell us some about it?
Yeah, you know, in fact, I was talking with your producer about this earlier. Our journey this year was kind of interesting. My wife got hired on a campaign down in Arizona called Equal Marriage Arizona, and she was actually the campaign coordinator down there to get marriage equality on the ballot down there, you know, saying two persons instead of a man and a woman, you know, have it be in the Constitution. And the experiences that we had down in Arizona, meeting with, you know, different groups and different people, really you know, manifested to us how important this issue is and just how it affects people of all different classes and races and all walks of life. And when the campaign ultimately went under and it was decided the strategy that state wanted to pursue was through the courts, which seems to be the general direction the country is headed, we moved back to Salt Lake City later, you know, this year, and we had the opportunity to get married. So it was an interesting capstone on our year of kind of, you know, equal rights and marriage equality and trying to have all these conversations with all of these different folks and what that means and, you know, who marriage equality is for. It's for these individuals that haven't had that legal recognition, no matter what state you live in. So, I mean, I really hope Arizona follows soon.
Yeah. Well, you talk a little bit about your relationship with the Mormon Church, which has so much influence in Utah?
Yeah, sure. I grew up Mormon. in the heart of Mormon country in Provo, Utah, and I'm the oldest of six kids. And I, my relationship with Mormonism is that, you know, I love the people so much in the church. I'm still a part of a group called Feminist Mormon Housewives, and I, you know, am very much a part of the community and a part of the culture, but I backed away a lot from, you know, the doctrine and the kind of heavy-handed, upper, top-level, down kind of way of structure of the church. That's not of interest to me, so that's kind of how I perceive it. But I feel like as far as Mormons and this issue of gay marriage, I think that it's a generational thing just like anywhere else. When I expressed that I had gotten married to my parents, they said, wow, we're a little bit shocked and a little bit wary, but my siblings got right on board and they could not be more happy or proud of me. Mm-hmm. And the thing about the Mormon church is that the leadership is not representative of the church. When you get involved in leadership in the church, you're in it until you die. So the people putting out the press releases on marriage equality are octogenarians. So the prophet of the church, he's turning 87 this year. So it's kind of like they're speaking for all the Mormons, and all the Mormons don't see it from the lens of an 80 or 90-year-old man, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure does. What about reactions from your friends who are in the church?
You know, they are so supportive and so happy. They said, when's your reception? When can we come? Where do we send wedding presents? You know, it's been unbelievable. There is just this incredible, overwhelming crush of support. And that's what's really changed, even in the past 10 years since Constitutional Amendment 3 has passed. I think that people have really come to understand the humanity behind what marriage equality means and how these issues affect each other, affect each of the individual issues, and how they affect real people. And so they've known Natalie and I for, you know, as a couple together for over 2 years, and they see that we're good life partners, and they just want us to be happy. And that's really the essence of how it is for them and how they see it in the church.
Do you sense, Nicole, that there will be a concerted effort to push back against this ruling?
From the Mormon church?
Uh-huh.
You know, I honestly think the church has backed down a lot. They got really embarrassed PR-wise after Prop 8, and they have really stepped out of the public sphere on this issue. They, after the ruling happened, they did send out a nuts and bolts press release about marriage being between the man and the woman and that they will let it go through the courts. But I think that the backlash that they received after Prop 8 was that, you know, people started to see them as political instead of, you know, as they see themselves as, you know, Christ-like and trying to help others. And when I was growing up, over the pulpit, the bishop would say right before an election, you know, follow your heart, vote however you want. The church doesn't support any candidates or any party. And the church really diverged from that in 2008, and I think that they recognize the error of their ways, and I think with this Judge Shelby ruling, they're going to really stay kind of in the background and not dump a lot of money into the legal fight or be very persuasive or try to use their powers or that kind of thing.
Nicole, one last question that's an important one for today. As we get into a new year, there are people listening to this interview who are still hoping or wishing for the reality that you now have in Utah. And they've done a lot of work like you have. They haven't experienced the success and advancement that you have. What would you say to some people, say two women just like you and your spouse, who have wanted this all along, who have experienced disappointment, who now fear delays like in California? Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? What would you say to them about staying the course?
I would just say that you know, equality marches on, and even in a place like Utah, it happened. It could happen in your state unexpectedly. And in 2013, the states that had marriage equality doubled, went from 9 to 18. And that is just exponential growth to me. And that tells me that this is unstoppable and that marriage equality will soon be something that is realized by all Americans.
Nicole Christensen married her partner, Natalie, in Salt Lake City on the day a judge's ruling made Utah the 18th state to allow marriage equality. We'll have to see what an appeal to the Supreme Court to stop the marriages will lead to, but there have been over 900 couples so far who've taken advantage of this very unexpected turn of events. Nicole, congratulations again. I wish you and Natalie the best in the new year, and I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Later in the show, the senior minister of the largest Unitarian congregation in America, which is found in Oklahoma. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Jeffrey Small, Jr. has had a successful business career, but has managed at the same time to establish himself as a respected public speaker and educator on spirituality and religion. With his broad study of world faith traditions, he may well be called a synthesist for the skill with which he brings together the knowledge gleaned from a lifetime of that study. In 2012, Jeff turned his hand to the writing of fiction, producing the best-selling book, The Breath of God. Now he's followed that up with a new work titled The Jericho Deception. And I am very pleased to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio. Jeff, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. Looking forward to our discussion today.
Would you please begin by talking about your study of world religions? I know that I have seen on Huffington Post your work about world religions, one excellent piece on what can be learned from various world religions. How has that always been a fascination for you?
I grew up in the Episcopal Church in Atlanta, but in addition to the Episcopal Church, was being here in the Deep South, was also surrounded by some more conservative religious traditions, mm-hmm. in which there was this sense that there was only one way to be saved, and that was through the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that aspect always rubbed me the wrong way. As I traveled around the world and met people of different cultures, from just the logical side of my brain, it didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I was also someone growing up that was a total math and science geek, and so that tension between spirituality and science was one that I played back and forth on as well, and was always searching for that kind of meaning there. And
mm-hmm.
so forms of religion that were too dependent on doctrine or too dependent on the authority that told me I had to believe in a certain way or I would be damned,
mm-hmm.
It didn't gel with what I saw was the real meaning of life and what we were learning from every other discipline that I was studying. And so for me, my own faith journey, while rooted in the Christian church, was one in which I kind of left the church for almost two decades in my 20s and into my 30s. And then as I started really studying a number of other faith traditions and spent time traveling through India in the Himalayas and studying yoga and Buddhism, it brought different dimensions to my own spirituality that I hadn't been exposed to in my youth in the Christian church. And then as opposed, though, to making me want to leave the church, it brought me back in and allowed me to then investigate some of these different spiritual traditions within the Christian community mm-hmm. and within our own Christian heritage that weren't as front and center. And so in a way, for me, the study of a number of these other religious traditions broadened my own Christian faith and allowed me to approach it from a multidimensional angle that I didn't appreciate earlier.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, Jeff, if I put my journey right alongside yours, it would be very, very similar up to the point that you begin to explore the other religions and have that nurtured by your travel. In my case, I had consumed about all of the guilt that I could consume from the time I was born in the evangelical tradition. And so all of my experience battled that guilt, had to be done on top of that. Did you feel the guilt, or did you feel, given your tradition in the Episcopal tradition, did you feel free to explore all that?
That's a great question. From the Episcopal tradition, I didn't get that guilt, but growing up in the South, and I went to a Christian high school growing up, that at the time was more on the conservative side, and we took Bible classes, and there were some teachers that were definitely of the ilk that if you didn't believe a certain way that you were condemned. And I was always the rabble-rouser in class that would raise my hand and say, well, you know, how did Noah get all of those animals on one boat? And, you know, why didn't the lions eat the rabbit? I was always, my nature was to question and to doubt. Yeah. But there were definite times as a teenager when I would be lying in bed that I would feel guilty about doubt and feel guilty about, well, I shouldn't be questioning about these issues of faith. Yeah. And I think the problem is my understanding then was limited, and that I believed that faith was a synonym for belief. And I think that's often what we're taught in kind of a simplistic form of Christianity,
right,
that all that it means is merely holding a certain set of beliefs about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And that equals faith, and that equals salvation. And I think as my views have become more nuanced, and especially as I discovered the theologies of Paul Tillich, in which doubt is an essential aspect of faith, and that starting to read the New Testament in a new life and seeing in some of Paul's letters that, you know, he's not using faith just as belief, but also faith in a sense of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that to me, as I started studying these other religious traditions, you have the idea of faith in all these different major religions.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it gets used in Hinduism and Buddhism is that faith is like trust. And as I took another step back and would look at kind of my scientific interests and saw, well, scientists have faith. You know, when a scientist goes into his lab, he doesn't start at square one and repeat the whole history of science up until that point. He starts at a period of faith that the scientific traditions before him, he's trusting in those prior experiments, those prior theories, and that then he takes that as the leaping point to further the knowledge. And
yeah.
So where I started kind of seeing faith was that trust in these prophets, these great spiritual leaders of the past, and that the different paths that they've taken had real meaning.
Yeah.
And that, however, that wasn't the end of the story. It didn't mean that I could shut off my own mind. And faith didn't mean believing in something that was unbelievable or having to not have reason in my brain, because obviously we are given the power of reason. It's part of one of our God-given gifts.
Yeah.
And so should we not be using that power of reason? And to me, a faith that doesn't question is a weak faith, and it's a faith that lives in fear that it may be vulnerable to something. So for me, the more I could almost take off the handcuffs and the shackles of not being able to question and being able to have that freedom to explore some of these other traditions and not feel guilty was just eye-opening, and it was so freeing for me And it's also what allowed me, I think, to come back to Christianity with a new vigor.
Jeff, I'm just amazed at the clear way in which you have helped us distinguish between faith and belief and how freeing that whole experience has been. How in the world did all of that take place while you were engaging in the enterprise of business and so many other kinds of involvements?
For me, I was fortunate to have a lot of professional and financial success early on in the business world. But what it left was a kind of an existential hole of questioning about what is life all about. And I find it interesting when I look at the history of the founders of some of the great world religions, we find that it starts happening, these kind of questionings start happening in middle age. And it's interesting that both Jesus and the Buddha, for example, were around the age of 30 when they kind of left their normal lives to go off, and Jesus was baptized at that age by John, went out into the desert where he's engaged in contemplation and prayer. The Buddha left his life at a palace to similarly kind of engage the spiritual quest. The prophet Muhammad was around the age of 40 when he was going out to a cave, Mount Hira, outside of Mecca, to meditate and pray at night and find himself. And that there's something, I think, in our lives that we reach certain milestones, and then we start questioning about what is it all about. And for me, because I had the professional success early in life, it led me to that spiritual journey and that spiritual search that led me into fiction writing with my two books, led me to go to Oxford kind of later in life, where I got a master's in world religions. And so it was that journey of what is meaning, what is purpose, and the realization that it's almost a cliche that it's not about power or money and success and notoriety, that those things may bring happiness, but it's fleeting, and that it is not a deep-centered joy that religion promises for us. And to me, that's the ultimate goal behind all of the world religions, and that they state that there is something interesting about the human condition in which we live, that while creation is good and existence and life is good, that there is a sense of discontent. There is that fall from Eden in which we live our states, and that we have lives that are filled with discontent, with anxiety, with pain, with sorrow, ultimately ending in death, and that the purpose of the world religions is, what do we do about this human condition? Mm-hmm. What is the path out of that kind of fallen state from the euphoria, the metaphorical Eden, and how do we get back to that?
Yeah.
And so it was those questions that started me on that spiritual journey that led me to start studying the different world religions, that began a meditation and centering prayer practice in my own life, and that led me to explore some of the great theologians of Christianity and some of the great Christian mystics as
yeah.
well.
Were you surprised by the success of your books? I mean, you just decided you could jump into this writing of fiction, and you've had as the same kind of success there you've had in other areas. Did that surprise you?
It didn't surprise me because it took a lot longer than I'm making it sound right now. My first novel, The Breath of God, was a six-year slugfest from starting the process to getting it published. And I had two dozen rejections from agents and publishers, rewrote the book dozens of times. In fact, as someone who had been successful in academia and in the business world, the process of writing fiction was a much more difficult process than I think I imagined it would be.
Hmm.
And that there's a real craft to it. And I had written a lot in my past, but I'd never tackled that craft of fiction writing. And it literally took me years of that heartache to and hard work and blood, sweat, and tears every single day plugging away at it in my free time in order to perfect it. And then even when it came out, I had a small publisher, and it was really through word of mouth that as people were finding that the book resonated with them, and they're passing them along, you know, to other friends, that The Breath of God really took off and became such a hit. And I think what I've tapped into there, both of my novels are unusual mixes of genres, in that I grew up enjoying reading mysteries and suspense and thriller novels. And so when I decided to write fiction, I wanted to write in that genre. But at the same time I was working on these books, I was going through my own spiritual journey. And so I wanted to bring that sense of spirituality and mysticism, which is very unusual in a suspense thriller. It might be as a separate genre in itself, but I wanted to blend those genres in a way. And sometimes I get compared a little bit to Dan Brown, but I think my readers that have read the book say that the comparison is superficial, and that as you get into the novels, that the sense of the philosophical questions that they raise and the spirituality aspects of it go a little bit deeper while still entertaining the readers in a way that kind of the genre can do.
I happen to agree with that from what I have read of your work, but because I think that it comes from a deeper place than Brown's works do, and you see more of yourself in what you're writing than perhaps in what he's writing. I'm curious as to what this process of writing has done to you. I know you write for other people, but how has the writing of The Breath of God and The Jericho Deception impacted your life?
It's interesting when you say, I write for other people. In a way, I think all writers, we do want our writing to be read.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, because it's so challenging in today's environment, just to finish a book, anytime I talk to a novelist that's finished a book or starting at one, I'm just so impressed because it's such hard work to do.
Yeah.
And getting published is very, very difficult in today's world and to get noticed. Ultimately, I think writing has to be about the author, him or herself.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the creative process is a spiritual process for me. And when I look at one of the qualities of God, I think of creation and creativity, whether it's the creative process that happens in evolution, the creative process through the Big Bang, through these beautiful mathematical laws that govern the universe. When I look at humanity and I see works of art or a Steve Jobs, a business genius, or a scientific breakthrough in Einstein, every aspect of the creative process has something divine in it, of that these ideas that seem to come out of nowhere and that are born. And for me, touching into that aspect is like touching the deepest aspect of my soul. And so as hard as it can be writing fiction, writing these books, I cherish my time every day when I sit down in the morning and the 2 hours that I have before I'm going to my office of where I can engage that spiritual, creative juice that's running through my blood. And so writing has fundamentally changed me. I mean, it gives me a pleasure and an outlook on life that I never had before. And so I write today because I have to, not with any expectation of making money or having people read it. And it's great when those things happen, but it's that spark almost of the divine coming out through me and through these ideas that really motivates me.
Jeff Small has combined a successful business career with work as a popular public speaker, educator, and now a best-selling author. Jeff, I think your story is an inspiration to many people who feel they have to choose between the practical concerns of making a living and the spiritual and intellectual call to explore meaning and purpose You've shown us a way to combine those. I congratulate you on your success, the success of your books, and I really thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio, and I hope that we can talk again soon through this medium.
I would love to, and thank you so much for having me on.
All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, describes itself as offering, quote, love beyond belief. With 1,800 active members, it's the largest Unitarian congregation in the nation, and even as many reports suggest that organized religion's growing exclusively among conservative traditions, it's an example of a progressive, engaged, and inclusive faith community in a place you might consider to be unexpected. I'm happy to be joined now by the senior minister of All Souls Church, the Reverend Marlon Lavenhar. Marlon, welcome to our show.
It's great to be talking with you today.
The portrayals of Oklahoma are all conservative, and they are, from my own experience in coming there numerous times and being in your town, they are wildly inaccurate. But still, many would assume that Oklahoma as a whole tends to lean in that direction. Please begin by talking about the folks that are drawn to All Souls and the broader community within which you work.
Well, here in Tulsa, we are a very conservative, religiously and politically conservative city on the whole, but there are a lot of people who are wanting their church community to also reflect the rest of their lives, where they're interacting with people at work and even in their own families who have different belief structures, different sexual orientations, different races and ethnicities. And so they're looking for a church experience that reflects that. Mm-hmm. And here at All Souls, our idea is that we don't have to believe alike to love alike. Mm-hmm. And so we've been able to draw a lot of different people to the church coming from different value structures and belief structures, but who all agree on the general mission of bringing the human family together for the good of all.
How long have you been there?
This is my 14th year here
and
at All Souls.
What was the church already going in that kind of direction, or have you been instrumental in guiding it that way?
Well, it was about 5 years ago, Welton, that All Souls here in Tulsa began to become much more racially diverse as well as diverse in terms of socioeconomic mm-hmm. levels. And so that all happened when a megachurch minister here in Tulsa, Bishop Carlton Pearson, who you may have mm-hmm. met or someone mm-hmm. you may know, he had a huge ministry here, very diverse, but predominantly African-American. And he was the right-hand man of Oral Roberts for many years. Mm-hmm. And his church had 5,000-6,000 members on a Sunday morning, but back around 2005, he came out to say that he believed that God was not going to send anybody to hell, not Jews, not Muslims, not Buddhists, and that was the beginning of the end of his megachurch empire here in Tulsa, mm-hmm. and eventually, the remaining members of his church, and he and his family joined All Souls back in 2008, and with that, we became, overnight, a very diverse church.
Yeah. I have met him, and it's a phenomenal story there, and it tells you something, though, about your congregation, that the arms and the doors of the church were open for that to happen.
Absolutely. Well, people have wanted to have a more diverse congregation. There's a sense here that the human family is yearning to be united in peace, but what it's going to take is our ability to live with and honor diversity. Mm-hmm. A lot of people and a lot of religions, it seems like, have the idea that peace will come when everybody conforms to one true belief. And we believe that that's never going to happen. And the way that we're going to find peace here on earth is by honoring diversity and learning to understand one another across our differences.
What a great insight. You know, I guess, that you're supposed to be in New England.
That's right. It's a Unitarian. Absolutely.
Yeah, to have the largest congregation of Unitarians in Tulsa seems like heresy to me. But an exciting part of your ministry is the success you've had in reaching out to younger people, which is a great concern for most churches.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about how you approach young people.
Well, one of the things, Welton, that we've been doing is creating a diverse set of worship experiences here. We have, on Sunday morning alone, we have a humanist-oriented service that does not have a lot of the trappings of religion in terms of prayers and hymns and other kinds of things, and yet has its own structure and offers the same message that we give in the other services, but through humanist language. And the music is more jazz and instrumental and very improvisational and wonderful and dynamic. Our second service is a more traditional Unitarian Universalist service, which does include hymns and choirs and a liturgy that if you plugged your ears, you might think you're in any Presbyterian or Methodist church around the country from everything that you see happening. But if you are listening, you're going to hear a much more progressive message than you'd hear in most other mainline churches around the country. And then in our later service, a contemporary service, which is infused with a lot of Bishop Pearson's former members, one of his former choirs from his church, has a more Pentecostal feel to it, and more Pentecostal music. It's overtly theistic in its theological language. And what we find is people are coming, and young people are coming across all these different styles of worship in order to hear the message and become a part of a community where they can be with their gay uncle can be there, as well as their agnostic coworker, and bring their own faith and their own style of worship, whether they like to raise their hands in worship and praise and sing to God, or whether they like to wrestle more with the intellectual ideas of values and ethics.
Have you been able to keep the people who attend those three services, have you been able to keep them from becoming three competitive congregations?
Absolutely. And I think of two gentlemen, Walter and Joe. Walter is a theist. He comes to our later service, is Pentecostal all his life. And Joe, who's a humanist and comes to our earlier service, these two older gentlemen in this case, they may attend different services on Sundays, but on Thursday afternoons, you'll find both of them working to build affordable housing through our house program here at All Souls. And that, I think, is a great expression of how they find love beyond belief, how they realize that they don't have to believe alike to love alike. Mm-hmm. And these are two gentlemen who probably would not be in relationship with one another, or may not think they agree with one another, had they not come together through All Souls.
My goodness. Reverend Levenhar, when you are up front of the congregation on a Sunday morning in these services, what's in front of you? What do you see? What are the people like that you see? What does diversity mean?
Well, in our case, diversity means young and old, black and white and Hispanic. You see gay and lesbian. So we'll see Republicans and Democrats as well, which surprises some people. We really have a very diverse congregation, and you'll see folks who are coming from a poorer background, a working class background, poorer background. You see people coming from, we have judges, lawyers, business leaders, CEOs, politicians in our community as well.
These are people, I assume, that are open to your encouragement to involve themselves in social justice and activism.
Absolutely. That's always been a central part of All Souls, and that's what brings us together, and a central part of Unitarian Universalism as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Christmas upon us here in the United States, we have this idea that we can bring peace and goodwill to all, and I think that's really what this congregation hopes to do.
So tell me, if you will, we don't have but just a minute or so left, tell me, what are you going to say about Christmas in your congregation?
This year, in my message about Christmas, I'm going to be talking about the ways in which God and the holy enter our lives at unexpected times and unexpected moments and in unexpected ways. If nothing else, one of the things I take away from the story of Jesus' birth from the Christian scriptures is this idea that here is this baby coming along, God, if you will, coming into the world in a manger, in a strange place, surrounded by animals, not at the time that's expected, not in the way that's expected, and that's how God often enters our lives. And that's part of where this diversity comes in. A lot of people never expected to find God through some of the folks who they're finding themselves worshiping with, people mm-hmm. who come from different walks of life, different cultures, even different belief systems, all worshiping together, making community together, and trying to make the world a better place together. And I think that's one of the greatest expressions of what the church is meant to be.
I sure do like your logo or your motto about the relationship between love and belief, because mm-hmm. what you've just described, I think about the Christmas story is the way love comes too. And just really do admire what you're doing. The Reverend Marlon Lavenhar is senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. During his tenure, that church has grown to be the largest Unitarian congregation in the United States with 1,800 members and a special outreach to young people of faith. Marlon, I wish you continued success in your ministry, and I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me on the program, and thanks for doing this program. I think it's fantastic.
Well, you're kind.
To all of us.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show, and we start a brand new year together. I'm excited about that. I want to invite you to visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely. We want to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find a lot more information about the topics that we discussed on this week's show, and you can find resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week. Use Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. You can use our listener line. We encourage it. The number is 202-681-4246. We encourage you, as always, to tell others about the show. We'd like, in the course of this year, to expand our listening audience and the diversity of it so that the conversations will be even more interesting and lively. Encourage others to listen so that we can include them in this national dialogue. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.